This is Radio Warnerd, and I am Mark Ames, the co-host of Radio Warnerd, and I'm on the other line now. I'm actually in Queens, in actual Queens, New York now, and I don't know why that just sounds weird to me, but it does. I guess if you're from California, it sounds very welcome back Cotter-ish. I don't know.
It does. It's way too colorful.
Yeah.
Are you going to do some? I think Queens is supposed to be working class, right? Are you going to put on a Brooklyn accent now? Brooklyn is another one of those places.
Exactly. Isn't it? It's all so different now. Brooklyn is now hipster central. Queens is, they all have working class parts and very yuppified parts. Anyways, as you probably heard already, I'm on the line with the Warnerd, a.k.a. Gary Brecher, a.k.a. John Dolan. And John, you're there.
I'm here.
Excellent.
In a glass booth in downtown Budapest because, you know, the sound quality wasn't great last time and we aim to please. So
we
this
do.
Time I'm sitting in a glass booth in a co-working space in downtown Budapest. And for telling me about co-working spaces, I want to thank listener Ingmar Johansson, who gave me a list of these places in Budapest. I'm in one called Kaptar now. And
thank you,
I'm
Ingmar.
Thank you, Ingmar. I'm looking at my horrible reflection in the glass of the booth, and with these big headphones over my ears, I look rather alarmingly like General Alfred Jodl at the Nuremberg trials.
and you're not too far away, so it's
no. I'm in that part of the world. My God,
is there sweat trickling down that head right now?
It's too grim for sweat. I got here early. I wanted to make sure I got here. So I was here by 4 p.m. And just walking around, you would have sworn it was midnight. The sun never really comes out. You know, it's funny. I spent a winter solstice in Western Ireland once. And that didn't seem quite as grim as this because the grass fluoresces somehow. It's like the light comes up from the ground. But not here. Budapest is all concrete and stone and
trees with no leaves, like these kind of
right
there. I remember that. Yeah, it is a somewhat sad one. And if I remember right, having written about suicide rates around the world, I think Hungary and all the Finno-Ugric people in general have the highest suicide rates in the world.
Wow.
Or definitely in the top 10. Yeah, I mean Hungary, Finland, Estonia, as I recall, they had among the very highest in the world, and some Finno-Ugric people inside of Russia too, maybe the Mari.
Yeah, what was that? Kanti something.
Kanti Mansiisk. Although they're not committing suicide because they have so much money now. That's where all the oil is.
Ah, right.
Yeah, so they're partying.
That's one method of suicide prevention. I would personally approve of that.
Money, I know. It's pretty simple. That's when they try to come. You know what they need? What these communities need is a lot of attention, education. No, they need money. Just give them money. It's pretty simple. All right, so let's get going. I mean, it's kind of fortuitous that we started up the Radio Warnerd podcast at this time because every week it seems to get batshittier and batshittier.
Yeah.
And even here in the U.S. or even here, it's always been pretty crazier, but it's, I don't know, in a gauche weird way.
The U.S. is winning the batshit thing right now. We can boast a little bit. The U.S. is in a different league. To the point that one of my Italian friends on Facebook, and Italians tend to be very polite people when dealing with Americans. They have a kind of, indulgent fondness for American culture from what I can see. But one of them finally said, "How can you justify this Trump thing? The next one of you who tries to justify it, I'm going to kick you." Kick away.
Somebody I know who's considered rather an extremist in France and who's not even particularly horrified by the National Front winning the elections there wrote to me saying, "I'm utterly horrified by Trump."
Yep, I know. It makes it hard to consider yourself any kind of edgy person because the edge is taken, and it's taken by a lot of crazy old white Americans.
Yeah, that's true. No, they're nuts. I know. I mean, they're like the graying stormtroopers. I don't know. They are crazy. I mean, maybe that is, fascism in its original form. It distinguished itself from other right-wing reactionary movements by appealing to youth as some kind of avant-garde revolutionary thing. But maybe that's not where you look for fascism anymore. It's what appeals to people on Social Security and who have 401ks and I don't know, and Medicare. Yeah. They're really angry all the fucking time.
And want to kill
a lot of people. Yeah.
Yeah, you kind of wonder if they've lived longer than they were supposed to.
I know. And the millennials are so just casual about everything and just they're sort of into kind of like riffing on Twitter or something. I don't get it.
Yeah.
When I was young, it was the other way around, but whatever.
I know, yeah. But I mean I don't want to talk about Trump 2 weeks in a row. He keeps doing things that make it hard to focus on anything else because as everybody knows by now, his latest proposal was to stop all Muslim immigration to the U.S., quote, until we figure out what the hell's going on or something like that. And that makes two proposals he's made which involve fascist solutions to minority group things. And these are solutions that have a long, long history in warfare because warfare has to be understood, as I've said many times, as something a lot bigger than Gettysburg or Stalingrad and Blue Hours versus Red Arrows. Warfare is kind of sped up demographics, let's say, forced demographics.
Mm-hmm.
As Céline is always reminding his readers, they used to call war the movement of the peoples. And you can make a move. And we're talking about ways of making people that you don't like move. He wanted to deport millions of Mexican Americans. Now he wants to ban every Muslim immigrant. And so we got to talk
or
about
visa
this.
any Muslim from entering the country. Period. And I think even American citizens. He was I can't remember where he's on that now, but he was sort of on both sides of that. If an American citizen who's Muslim is outside of the country and then comes back and at passport at customs says I'm a Muslim, they might also be excluded.
Yeah, I read a comment from some so-called respectable Republican who said, you know, he needed to say, accept American citizens.
Yeah.
And he didn't say that. And that bothered me. It's like, the rest is fine.
I love the idiots who are like, this isn't constitutional. Then the Constitution. Yeah. The Constitution says black African slaves are 3/5 human beings.
Yeah.
I mean, it's not the most progressive document out there. Yeah.
No, and in 1882, Chinese Exclusion Act was passed, which basically did what the kind of thing that Trump is talking about, basically saying no more Chinese. And it wasn't coy about it. It said no more Chinese, period.
Right. And California mostly in the Southwest, but mostly California, mostly the farms there. There was a mass expulsion of Mexicans, both undocumented migrant workers and apparently hundreds of thousands of Mexican-American citizens. I mean, some people who are probably there, whose families were there before we took it from the Mexicans. And so something like close to 1 million were forcibly expelled in the 30s.
Well, yeah, I mean, the history of the Constitution is that it tends to vanish when people get excited.
Mm-hmm.
The racist rage is a very easy way to get people excited all over the world. So I thought we could talk about ways in mass expulsions, population transfers, ethnic cleansing, whatever you want to call them, in the history of warfare. And
war is movement of people. I mean, that's
the movements of the peoples.
Right.
That really is a good non-moral way of talking about it, if you want a non-moral way of talking about it. And the terms are very important. The language is very important because I think I mentioned this on Facebook, but I should tell people that Amnesty International, which has taken a really weird stance on what's going on in Syria, wrote a very critical report on the Kurdish forces, the YPGJ, in northern Syria. The YPGJ allowed Amnesty International observers to move around freely in the areas they controlled, to talk to anybody they wanted to, and Amnesty came back with a report that said, we talked to some Arab inhabitants who said they'd been forced to move, and instantly this was used by Erdogan's people, this was used by every Turkish nationalist, and every anti-Kurdish Islamist to say, see, Amnesty International itself says the YPG is committing ethnic cleansing. Right. So I wrote, I mean, I've lived in Kurdistan. I was very surprised by this, and I found it very hard to believe, and it doesn't tally with what I know about YPG. So I wrote to Amnesty International to say, perhaps you should take another look. You don't seem to have the kind of evidence that would justify accusing the YPG of ethnic cleansing. And my response was, thank you for your email. Amnesty International...
This is, you mean their response to you?
This is Amnesty's response, yes, to me, from somebody named Kirsten.
Okay.
Amnesty International does not accuse the YPG of ethnic cleansing.
Okay, wait, stop there already, because that's already... That opening line is huge, and that has not been reported anywhere.
No.
That needs to be put in an article. That's a direct statement. Amnesty International does not accuse the YPG of ethnic cleansing. Period.
No.
Okay.
Yeah. It is rather remarkable because it has been... That accusation has been tossed around, and I've been following the stories that toss it around. Like when, you know, a British guy who fought for the YPG was banned from a British university, the student union said, you know, Amnesty has accused YPG of ethnic cleansing. And I certainly didn't hear Amnesty saying, no, we didn't. So what we're dealing with is some kind of terminological issue. Mm-hmm. I read their report, which puts me, I think, in a pretty small minority. And it's a very hostile report. There isn't a lot of evidence, but there is a lot of so-and-so told us this happened, so-and-so told us that happened. It does not accuse Amnesty, accuse the YPG of any violence against Arab residents of the area it controls, which, if you know the standards of warfare in Syria, is pretty remarkable as a testimonial to them. But it does say houses were demolished, but they don't. This is all based on secondhand testimony, and these—I mean, I assume Amnesty has some sort of savvy about how reports like this are used and digested.
Yes.
I'm one of a tiny, tiny minority of people who actually read them, and what happens is Amnesty says YPG is ethnically cleansing. And so, yeah, it is kind of remarkable that when I asked them about that, they said, no, we didn't. But that's because one of the things about, let's call it forced transfer of populations as a way of making war, is that it's changed totally since 1945. I mean, this is, I've said this before, the world before 1945 and after 1945, huge gulf there that isn't always recognized. Before 1945, expelling people, transferring whole populations, a lot of times it was the nice option, the humane option, because the other option was kill them all, and that was a reasonable option. After that, it began to get more and more pejorative, and the history of that is really kind of interesting, because it all happened right at a certain point between 1945 and 1946. First, the Volga Germans were booted at the end of the war. A lot of other populations were booted at the end of the war.
Sudeten Germans also, right?
Right, yeah. And then a few months later comes the Nuremberg trials, and then the defendants are put on trial, among other things, for forced population transfer. And at that point, it becomes an unacceptable way of waging war. So there's something a little sleazy and disingenuous about the whole thing. And even when, I mean, when you look at what happened in the Balkan Wars, that was a place where the U.S. was amping certain expulsions and downplaying other ones because we had a long-term revenge mission there. I mean, Kosovo basically was the U.S. claim was, and it's a reasonable claim, this is the Balkan War, it's the nasty business of massacre and counter-massacre, claim was up to 800,000 Albanian Kosovar were forced out, and then when they were moved back with the aid of U.S. Air campaign against Serbia, then the Serbs were forcibly moved out of Kosovo. Right. The difference is the Albanians came back, the Serbs didn't come back. So it wasn't a good guy, bad guy thing, and these things rarely are. It was a expulsion, counter-expulsion. Mm-hmm. And what counts is it's kind of musical chairs thing, you know, who's standing at the end of it. And in this case, the Albanian Kosovar were. But, you know, this all goes way, way back. And the reason, there's something about Trump that echoes ancient solutions. You know, he's a real old school guy in the way he thinks about things. Because the history of booting out a population you don't like goes way, way back. I mean, the Inca apparently were fond of this. I don't know much about the Inca, and I don't think too many people do because they were weird. I remember an old National Lampoon article where they were talking about...
That's where we get our information.
It used to be good, actually.
Say that.
Oh, yeah. This was when it was good. Yeah. And that's why I remember this line. They had a graph of... medical treatments from different cultures and different eras, and you know, the Romans, you know, eat garlic, and then the Inca would be at the end of the chart, and it was always something incredibly weird. The one I remember is steal a corn-studded turd to confound those who would mock you.
That'll show them.
Yeah.
Wow. The Inca, Chuvash, I should just interrupt, you know, the ultimate way of getting revenge in ancient, at least pre-communist, I guess, Chuvashia, the Chuvash people in the Volga River region, is to hang yourself on their doorstep so that when they open the door and see you hung there, basically their lives are ruined forever. Ha ha! You know, burn.
Yeah, you'd be amazed. It always shocks me how these supposedly ancient warlike cultures were passive aggressive as hell.
Yeah.
You know, in Ireland, the ultimate, you know, pre-Christian Ireland, the way to shame the hell out of somebody who'd done something terrible to you, sit on their doorstep and starve until you fell over this emaciated corpse. That'll teach you. Ah.
Stop it. Eat something. Damn. God. Yeah, pretty weird species, no doubt. Yep. For all of us.
So, people were very fond of transferring one.
Oh, can you speak up a little louder? Slightly louder.
Okay. The Inca were apparently, and I don't claim to be an expert about the Inca, but I've been researching this, and they were apparently very good at transferring one ethnic group from, say, the southern mountains to the northern plains, or vice versa. The Babylonians and Assyrians were also very fond of this method when they did. Well, you know, the Assyrians, their method was terror, just pure terror. I mean, there's that famous Assyrian cuneiform tablet that begins, "I have flayed all the chief men of the town." And there's an illustration showing the other luckier chief men of the town being impaled on sharp spikes. But occasionally they had large populations where you couldn't flay or impale everybody. And then they would simply move a population into an area where...
I should say, I'm sorry to interrupt, but, you know, the Old Testament, we always talk about it because I finally read it out in Kentucky. What surprised me so much is that it's basically, I mean, a book of a bunch of people screaming half the time, and the other half the time is Yahweh screaming at the Israelites for not ethnically cleansing all of the non-Hebrews. And every time, you know, if there's a drought, if somebody, you know, I don't know, their business went bad, their crops went bad, everything was always almost invariably because either A, they didn't ethnically expel outsiders, or B, because they didn't thank Yahweh enough. It's usually what it came down to, is those two things. Cleanse the land. And that's why, you know, these loony settlers, I mean, they're going by the book.
No, we're talking about the Babylonian exile, right? Mm-hmm. Because when I was researching this, one of the classic examples of exile is the Jews. And there seems to be general agreement that the Babylonian exile in, I think, the 6th century BC was quite real and pretty brutal. Mm-hmm. But there's a lot of argument about whether these Roman exiles mm-hmm. were real. And naturally, the trouble with this kind of argument, it always comes down to where you stand on Israel right now.
Right.
And there's always some contemporary issue just that's hidden under these discussions of the ancient world.
Yeah.
But apparently everybody agrees that there was a mass expulsion of Hebrews from Palestine or Israel or whatever you want to call it, under the Babylonians. Mm-hmm. And it was why, you know, guerrilla warfare and revolts were pretty rare until recently, because something like that waited for you if you started one. Your whole people would be expelled, your houses would be burnt or given to some other tribe, and the collective punishment would be the norm. There would be no question that collective punishment would follow. And the pejoratives, ethnic cleansing, collective punishment, they weren't pejorative ones.
Mm-hmm. Right. So they were basically kinder ways of dealing with these things. And now they're war crimes.
Compared to killing everybody.
Right. And now they are considered war crimes. And that's why things like amnesty reports are so important. I mean, what amnesty did was one step away from you know, potentially, if it were in interest of some powerful countries, triggering some sort of legal process that could stigmatize them or isolate them or have us bomb them or whatever. I mean, it is, if I were the YPG, I would see that as a threat from the West, and I'm not sure what else is going on there, but I would see that as a pretty serious threat.
Yeah, well, the Kurds in the YPG anyway have a very ill-advised trust, I think, in the West, and I'm not sure it's going to work out for them. They've been betrayed many times before. I mean, I don't know. There are many times when this strategy works. That's what's scariest about it. I mean, there. I want to talk about a couple of cases in particular, like Eastern Turkey, Eastern Anatolia. I mean, what happened there is really remarkable, and it involves the Kurds. Like, southeastern Turkey is now thought of as Kurdish territory. The Armenians in Turkey are almost gone. But it used to be that Eastern Turkey was Armenia. It was the western part of Armenia that continued until it ran into Georgia along the Black Sea and Azerbaijan towards the Caspian Sea. And the Armenians were tolerated at most as a Christian minority in the Ottoman Empire. But the Ottomans were under pressure from Russia, right? Because all this involves population pressure one against another. The Russians were pushing Muslim populations south into the protection of the Ottoman Empire, and that made them muhajir, something like fellow Muslim refugees.
Mm-hmm.
So the Ottomans had to welcome them, and they had to find a place for them, and they didn't want to give up their own land, so they said, go settle on the Armenians' land.
Mm-hmm.
And so for all through the 19th century, the Armenians were coming under more and more pressure. This used to be Armenian farmland, Armenian peasantry.
Mm-hmm.
And then these immigrant Muslims, and also very much the Kurds.
Mm-hmm.
The Kurds were raiding them, more or less with impunity, because the Armenians were seen, after 1850 at least, as trouble. And then Russia annexed Eastern Armenia in the Russo-Turkish War in 1877, 1878. And that made Armenians seem like pro-Russian traitors to the Ottomans. The Ottomans licensed basically land privateers, these Turkish militias called Hamidiye, and said basically, go take whatever you want from those Armenians. And this was under Abdul Hamid II, whose nickname, to give you an idea of the tone of all this, was the Butcher. Mm. The Kurds had a huge part in these massacres. But the amazing thing is, even though the Kurds played a role in this up to the 1915 massacres that really finally wiped out the Armenians in Turkey, the Kurds have finally acknowledged that, unlike the Turkish government or most people in Turkey. And they've all apologized. And in fact, Abdullah Öcalan, the Turkish leader, said, after all, we should remember that when Hitler decided to massacre the Jews, some of his advisors said there might be trouble. And he said, why? Who complained about the Armenians? Mm. And what happened with the Armenians in the last years of the Ottoman Empire, not under the Sultan anymore, this was under the military dictatorship, was a good lesson in how you do a mass expulsion so that it becomes a genocide. Similar example in the U.S. is the Trail of Tears, mm-hmm. where you send a civilian population a long way with no provision for proper food, water, winter clothing, anything. And it's not just you're not worried they might die, you are frankly hoping they will die. Mm-hmm. You just don't have to say so out loud.
Right. So, I mean, it's you don't have to sully your own hands and traumatize, as it were, your own troops by making them kill them. But
There was a poem called The Latest Decalogue, you know, a sarcastic updated Ten Commandments written during the Irish famine. And it had the line, thou shalt not kill, but needs not strive officiously to keep alive. Mm. And that's the theory of this kind of warfare, and it is a kind of warfare. Mm-hmm. It worked. There are no Armenians in Turkey now, and that was what the founders of modern Turkey wanted, as I've said before, a completely unitary ethnic state. And they pretty much got it. With the Greeks, they had to do a formal expulsion exchange of population. With the Armenians, they basically killed or drove out all the Armenians. And the Kurds had a big part of that. So what we think of as the Kurdish part of Turkey now used to be the Armenian part of Turkey. Mm. And the Kurds know that. They're very uneasily aware of that.
And by the way, this explains for people who maybe aren't aware of, for example, why Armenia remains so friendly with Russia, when so many of the other former Soviet republics, you know, went away as quickly as they could and embraced the West. This is why. I mean, the Armenians certently in the last 150 years, I mean, Russia has been their only somewhat reliable protector.
Yep.
In a very hostile region.
Yep. Yeah. I mean, this is a very common strategy all over the world. It's remarkable. I mean, the more I looked into it, the more you see. I mean, there was sort of an earlier attempt in Anatolia to establish a stable Turkish Muslim population, and that was the 15th century. And if you look at the two ends of Europe in the 15th century, something really weird is happening. The Christian kingdoms in Spain are pushing south until they finally conquer Granada in 1492, the same year Columbus sails. About 40 years earlier, 1453, the Turks finally take Constantinople, the last Byzantine stronghold on Asia Minor. So you've got talk about a population exchange. It's almost balanced in some strange way. You get a more unitary Muslim state on the east side and a unitary Christian state on the west side. But the Spanish and the Turks both had trouble with the remnants of those populations. I mean, the Spanish had to do a lot of cleansing, and I believe, Mark, that some of your ancestors took a compulsory.
They were pushed out into Morocco, Malta, Morocco, as far as I know. But they lived in, they were Sephardic Jews, and they lived in Oh my God, which one was it? It was either Barcelona or one of the cities in the south. Now I can't remember the goddamn Cordoba maybe, or shit. Right. I can't remember the name. It was one of those. But in any event, I do keep that in mind, and there is proof of it. And I'm thinking, if Spain doesn't get rid of their universal healthcare, I'm getting my citizenship, goddammit.
Yeah.
Because I suffer.
Well, yeah, in case people don't know, Spain has offered citizenship.
Yeah, not to the Muslims, which is funny. It's interesting, that they kicked out. But to the few Sephardi that can probably prove it in some way or another.
Yeah.
Healthcare, here I come.
You hear a lot of right-wing stuff about taqiyya, the supposed Muslim doctrine of hiding your faith for subversive purposes. But what they don't tell you is taqiyya is what Spanish Muslims resorted to after the conquest, when they were given the option of converting or leaving or dying.
We had, there were Amzalaks in Portugal who were Catholic that kept in touch with the family. My grandfather's generation anyway kept in touch with them. So that would explain that, yeah.
Yeah. So finally, the Spanish, the Spanish were pretty Wahhabi about their Catholicism. They were not satisfied with the degree of conversion. They were always looking for crypto Muslims or crypto Jews. But the interesting thing is the Muslims seem to have bothered them much less than the Jews. I don't know why that is. I mean, as we saw in post-war Poland, you can have anti-Semitism without Jews. So whether these were real crypto Jews or imaginary crypto Jews, I don't know. But they ended up expelling huge numbers of people suspected of crypto Judaism a century after that initial conquest.
That's interesting. Well, I mean, it could be because if you actually read the New Testament again, this went back from when these born agains and evangelists were, gave me the old and New Testament in Kentucky. If you read it, the Jews come off pretty bad. I mean, and it's funny because I spent a lot of time in my youth in churches, and I didn't remember any of this stuff. And the Jews are, I mean, I don't know how else to put it. They're asking for it, literally, in Matthew and so on. I mean, they are taunting God. I mean, God, the Son of God, the guy who suffered more for everybody. And the Jew, I mean, and of course, this book, as I like to say, this book is written by Jews, and nobody knows anti-Semitism like Jews.
Right.
And but I mean, it's there are portions of the Bible that seem designed to make you really hate Jews. I mean,
well, before we go on, I should give one more plug to one of the greatest reviews ever written. That is Mark Ames' review of the Bible. One of the funniest reviews I've ever read. And as you say in that review, once you read the Bible, you realize it's nothing but Jewish self-love and self-hate in some kind of toxic, unstable mixture all the way through.
With a God to bounce it off, because God sometimes loves them and God sometimes just hates them as the most ingrateful, horrible people that ever existed. I can't believe there's a Chaldean, still on this territory. What did I tell you 100 times already? Kill him.
Well, yeah, and that also gets very close to something we're talking about, which is, despite the pretty much uniform savagery of the world in that era, there's a sense in those stories that sometimes the winners are reluctant to kill everybody, and that is the safest solution. And Yahweh keeps telling them, as you write in your review, kill them all. And if I remember correctly, he also tells them, kill their livestock, right?
Probably, yeah, at least some of the times. He kills livestock a lot. He's a real dick. I mean, he definitely kills a lot of livestock. Sorry, lightning. No. Okay.
We should get Mike Judge to review in a butthead voice. That's a dick.
He sucks. Yeah.
But that was the norm. You kill every male of military age and you sell the others as slaves. And the idea of giving them the option of leaving, even if it's with no belongings and no water or no nothing, is a relatively mild solution to that.
Right.
Until 1945, this is something that just goes on all over the place. There's a blurry line. There's a, what I suppose we could call a spectrum between simple mass expulsion and then something like outright genocide. And there's a lot in between, like how much do you let them take with you? How much time do you give them? Do you make any distinctions? Do you say the men can't go with them, in which case you're basically dooming them to death because they're going to be sold as slaves by the first tribe whose territory they cross? You know, there are all kinds of hideous and yet polite ways of arranging for these things to become death sentences. And this goes on in Africa now. As I've written before, in what's called bush war in Africa, often you kill very few people directly, but you kill them in the most horrible way you can. You know, you rip their genitals open and lie them out on a courtyard, a crossroads rather, because the word will get out really fast. And when the word gets out, everybody in their tribe will run. And when they run into dense mosquito-filled bush, and they usually don't have any water. And the children die really, really quickly under those conditions. Mm-hmm. Small children die within a few days without water and without care. And this is what the Sudanese did to the big tribes in South Sudan, the Dinka and the Nuer. They pushed them out into the swamps, and a huge number of them died. The Sudan War that nobody talks about killed at least 2.5 million people, almost all of them civilians. And very few of them were killed with bullets. They were just killed by being forced out into the swamps to die. Mm-hmm. The Sudanese government used the same tactics later in a better publicized war in Darfur against Fur and the Zaghawi. That time there wasn't even a sectarian dimension. The Dinka and the Nuer are largely Christian, so there was a lot of sectarian angle there. But the Fur and the Zaghawi, the people in Darfur, they're Muslim. It was just they got in the government's way. So they were forced to hit the road in a desert and encouraged to die, as is usually the case.
Is that the case too in, I think, the biggest, in terms of deaths, war in Africa, in the Congo?
Right. Yeah. Because, this is the hottest, wettest place in the world. It's very easy to die there. That may have killed more than 3 million people. Mm-hmm. And, again, very few of them died by bullets. Most of them died, and this often gets called, I think very reasonably, the Great War of Africa. Mm-hmm. Most of them died of disease after being forced into the rainforest, and overwhelmingly it's the children who die. There's a kind of horrible logic to it. You're making sure that the enemy ethnic group can't bother you for a good long time, because the boys who would be fighters in 15 years are going to be dead soon. So you're fixing it down the line.
So what about I'm trying to think, because you're right, you don't think about too many population transfer stories pre-20th century. Mostly when I think of this, I think like whether it's the Romans or Genghis Khan, you basically had a choice, either submit or we wipe out every single one of you. And then if you do something worse, we're also going to salt the earth after we wipe you out. It was pretty much not a very big menu. And so I was just actually kind of straining to think about this right now. But one thing that comes up is, you know, Cromwell's army. And
yeah, that's one of the better known examples, because although the Irish have messed up a lot of things, the one thing they did that was surprisingly radical was say, just because you're bigger and stronger than us, this you're not right, which was quite a radical idea until very recently. It's a radical idea now, actually. But so they managed to publicize this thing. I mean, I remember as a kid from a very, one side of the family at least, very nationalist family, before I knew anything real about Irish history, I knew the phrase, to hell or Connaught. And this is what Cromwell's people supposedly told the Catholic Irish who wouldn't convert after 1650, when they said, where can we go if you take over our lands? The answer was to hell or Connaught. Connaught is one of the traditional provinces of Ireland, the part that nobody really wants to go to. It's out there on the Atlantic. That's where I spent that winter solstice, and you don't want to be there in the winter. There was a storm that knocked the power out for like a week. Oh, God, nothing to do but stare at that cow looking in the window and watch its tail getting blown in the wind. So Connaught is not a place you'd want to go. And yeah, a lot of them, they were booted out of the more inhabitable parts of Ireland to the east.
Maybe for some listeners who don't know what happened, I mean, can you give a brief description of just the whole?
Yeah, that, sure. Yeah. After the English Civil War, the Irish, taking advantage of the old and very dangerous maxim, England's danger is Ireland's opportunities, said, aha, they're busy fighting each other, we'll revolt again. But they didn't count on Cromwell's new model army, which first smashed the royalists in England, then went north and smashed the Scots. And as they moved from England to Scotland, they got a lot rougher, because the Scots were Protestant, yes, but they weren't English. So they got a lot rougher there. And then they sailed over to Ireland, where people were neither English nor Protestant, and it was like, all bets are off, we're going to kill you. And the suppression of the revolt there was particularly bloody, and it was followed in classic manner. And this is part of that, part of the logic of forced expulsion. Okay, how do you pay off your troops? Well, when you expel the former inhabitants, those disloyal traitors, you give their land to your troops. And this is why a lot of the landed families in Ireland had very ordinary names that would be lower middle class in England, you know, the Jacksons, Squire Jackson or something, because those were Cromwell's soldiers. And they were awarded land in Ireland as a reward for suppressing the rebellion. 100,000 of the Irish were sent as slaves to the West Indies and the Americas, which gets into a lot of really stupid, you know, Irish self-pity politics, like, we were slaves too! Yes. The rest were forced out of the good land onto the West. But, you know, the Empire did a lot of expulsions.
I'm sorry, but that's how you got Ulster and Northern Ireland as a
predominantly there were later plantations too.
Right.
And at, earlier and later, under James, even before Cromwell. But
yeah, so in terms of other areas of the empire, I mean, the British seem to be among the masters. The British and Stalin seem to be kind of two masters of population transfers.
Yep, they were brilliant. I mean, the Acadians and the French of Nova Scotia, I mean, they're the reason we have Cajuns in Louisiana, because after the French lost Nova Scotia, French settlers were expelled because they were unreliable. Their loyalty wasn't assured. They were the wrong ethnic group. Classic stuff. They were booted back to France, but some of them wanted to live in America, so they tried somewhere a little further south, ended up in Louisiana, and became Cajuns. There were a lot of, imperial transfers. Fiji, for example, is now roughly half ethnic Fijian, half North Indian. Those North Indians were sent under imperial rule as cheap labor for the cane fields. Same kind of thing that, you know, Naipaul's ancestors.
Right, were. In Trinidad.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And just ship after ship of Gujarati from northern India were brought in. And this, you know, on a small island chain like Fiji, this had very disastrous political effects. But there, it wasn't even an explicitly political decision. It was just a typical Victorian, callous, ham-handed capitalist move.
Mm-hmm.
They needed a lot of labor. They needed it cheap. They wanted people who wouldn't have any local power or any ties to the place. Mm-hmm. So they just shipped them in, most of them opium addicted, and put them to work.
Yeah, that's why, I mean, that's why bosses, employers, owners of whether it's plantations or mines or railroads, whatever, they love open border immigration because you can set different groups off against each other. Basically, it lowers wages and it makes it harder for them to organize back against you. And especially if you can put two different people against each other in your...
Absolutely.
Yeah, that's the best. Like, I'm just reading now about how the coal mines in western Pennsylvania, some the major owners of the coal mines, who are also owners of the railroads, they would bring in the Welsh miners to do the mining inside the coal mines, and then have the Irish doing unloading the coal up above the mine, and partly to set them off against each other. And one of this huge innovation, at least in labor history, was that the two came together. And that's when the shit hit the fan, and they brought in the Pinkerton. It's a long and really depressing, gory story, but yeah.
And that's why, when we get it, when we bring it back to Trump's two policies, mm-hmm. I mean, there's a real difference between deporting Mexican Americans and banning further Muslim immigration. Because if he really was serious about deporting Mexican-Americans, I think the people who own America would get very annoyed with
him. Yeah, they like to talk about it. What they like to do is allow in as many as possible and then talk about it and even sort of help inside fund some groups that turn everybody against the Mexicans rather than against the employers and the people who benefit from this the most.
Yeah. I've actually had arguments with Republicans where you say, oh, come on, don't you know they're just using you and they'll never really oppose cheap labor? And they always come back with something that implies they do know that. Something like, well, what are we supposed to do, vote for Hillary?
Exactly.
Something like that.
No, that's exactly right. I mean, the other side is openly pro. It doesn't even throw them a spite bone. Yeah, it's true. Yeah. One other thing I would say about what Trump is doing too... It reminds me of this one time when I was on Rattigan's show on MSNBC, and they used to pick me up in this car, and there was this one of the guys who drove me once. This African American guy told me he had a real fondness for Pat Buchanan for some reason before Pat Buchanan was kicked off for good from the show for his anti-Semitism. And he told me, I mean Buchanan is a charmer and a smart guy, and just he's just a bit sick, but in any event, he said, Buchanan told me once that the key is to always, before there's any kind of controversy out there, create the controversy, no matter how bad even it may make you kind of look when people scream, because you then you're the one that can kind of control the solution. Everyone's talking about you, and you can then guide it. But if somehow from the outside somebody creates the controversy or something and involves you, you have no control over it. You can't sort of squirm your way out of it. And he's like, that's one of the just basic keys to like tactics to all this.
Wow.
I think Trump really took that to heart. I mean, and what's amazing about Trump too is when he says these crazy, like, it doesn't matter what crazy fucking thing he says, it's sort of like a boil has been lanced. I don't know. I mean, people are just... It's like this pent up, yes, we've all wanted to say these fucking crazy things. We've been waiting, and all we've been getting is sort of coded BS from guys who are equally racist and nutty, probably even more racist and fascist than Trump is, like, the Pauls and Ted Cruz. I mean, what a fucking loon that guy is.
That's actually a useful distinction. I think Ted Cruz is a fascist by nature. I mean, Trump just seems like...
opportunist.
An opportunist, yeah.
And a really good, I mean, he's really good at it. I don't know what his end game is, and I don't think he cares, and that's where the $1 billion comes in. He's figuring that this is all going to be good somehow, no matter what.
Yeah.
But anyway, so bringing it back to him, I'm sorry to cut you off there, like, how does what Trump is proposing, if you even take it at face value, I mean... How do you put it in historical context? But I guess what sense can you make out of it, or what can be done?
Yeah, well, it depends on whether you think it's real. I mean, mm-hmm. I suppose the U.S. could make a rule. No, I'm... I get wobbly when I'm dealing with the U.S. I think you know the U.S. a lot better than I do. For one thing, you're there and I'm not. But just offhand,
these people
it seems
are crazy.
To me that the Mexican,
that's all I can say.
The Mexican proposal is just ridiculous. It's not going to happen. The other one, I don't know. Could that happen?
I mean, if you think about things you thought couldn't happen that did happen, I suppose it could happen for a while or something like it. What's really freaky is after Trump said this, there was this immediate, holy shit, I can't believe that line was crossed from pretty much everybody across at least the official spectrum. And this is where Trump's value really comes in. This is why the people who love him, love him. He's saying the things that no one's allowed into, you know, official discourse, right. and then getting away with it, like nobody can do anything about it.
Well, what I would say is that when something like this has happened more recently, it's been given a kind of fig leaf of exchange of populations, like what Turkey and Greece did after Greece lost the war against Turkey in 1923 was officially an exchange of population, mm-hmm. even though 1.5 million Greeks were kicked out of Turkey and only 340,000 Christians, that's mm-hmm. how they did it, by sect, not by ethnicity. Mm-hmm. 1.5 million Christians were kicked out of Turkey, 345,000 Muslims were kicked out of Greece. So it was a very one-sided transfer, but it was officially a transfer, right? We mm-hmm. both agree to this. It's fine. So there was that wave. Always these things happen after a war. There was that big wave in 1918 after the Great War, another wave in the Eastern Mediterranean in 1923. Then from 1940 to 1945, Stalin is moving peoples around at will, basically. I mean, the Chechens were thrown into cattle cars and sent to Kazakhstan.
As were the Crimean Tartars.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
And they're being used
just
against
on them. Suspicion.
Yeah. Right.
And then there's a really interesting wave in 1947 to 1949. Two rather well-known places, the India-Pakistan mm-hmm. exchange and Palestine-Israel. Mm-hmm. Start with the India-Pakistan thing. At the last minute, basically, Britain decides that India won't be India anymore. It'll be divided into a Hindu part and a Muslim part, and the Muslim part will be called Pakistan, and it'll be up around Punjab. And in order for this to happen, there has to be a lot of population transfer, and that became a monstrous bloody mess. Mm-hmm. There were probably 800,000 people killed just in Punjab. The worst of it was that when these two countries were defined by their sect, there was a third sect, the Sikh, mm-hmm. who weren't given 1 acre of land, even though they were in the area affected. And the British did a very thorough job of absolutely destroying the Sikhs. It took more than a century to do, but they were totally destroyed. And this was the last straw, because the Muslims got what's now Pakistan, the Hindus got what's now India, the Sikhs got nothing. They've been revolting, trying to have their homeland, Khalistan, ever since. But that's one of the problems when you try to do this exchange of population and sectarian division. There's almost always a third and a fourth and a fifth population in there somewhere, and they're going to get crushed.
Mm.
especially when you make a monosectarian country like Pakistan, they're going to be completely crushed. And the Sikhs knew that would happen. So basically, they got out of Pakistan as fast as they could, because they liked their chances better in India, and they were right about that.
Mm-hmm.
But there are stories that really sicken you. Like there were trains full of those pictures of Indian trains with people mm-hmm. hanging on the sides and all that. You know, classic tourist image. Well, you know, you can string a wire just above the roof of the cars, and that will kill everybody who's on the roof. And that was a common method of dealing with refugees from a sect you didn't like. It was really, really nasty things. Mm. And then almost at the same time, there's that other thing that's caused, as people have probably heard, a bit of a kerfuffle.
Also, thank you, Britain.
The whole Israel-Palestine thing.
Yeah. I remember Phil Collins had a line, Arabs and Jews, boy, too much for me.
Did he really?
Yes.
That's a real Trump line.
He is kind of the Trump of prog rock.
The Trump of pop. Yeah. Yeah. And I don't know. I think most people have heard one or more versions of what happened, and we're not going to persuade anybody to change their mind about which version they believe.
Well, but what is interesting about what happened in Palestine, Israel, is that the Israelis, the Jews, really put in a lot of effort to make it seem like there was not any sort of forced expulsion of people at all. That they that not only did they do it voluntarily, but that they did it as part of a devious plan to massacre all the Jews. And that's I don't know how common that is, but it's just interesting that post Nuremberg trials, that when you did a population expulsion transfer, whatever, like that, you know, you put in a lot of effort to construct a story that completely indemnifies you and actually vilifies, you know, the victims of the expulsion.
Yeah. Well, I think for one thing, the creation of Israel had, at least in the West, maybe not in the Middle East, but in the West, it had a lot of momentum behind it because of Auschwitz.
Right,
because
exactly.
Of the death camps.
And
the world was willing to cut a lot of slack at that point.
Yeah.
And also, as I discussed last week when we were talking about Dune, Arab sensibilities didn't particularly matter until quite recently mm-hmm. in Western public discourse.
Right.
That's a big change that I've seen in the last decade.
Mm-hmm.
Unfortunately, it's accompanied by even less interest in sub-Saharan Africa, but, you know, mm-hmm. that's the way it goes. At the time, I don't think anybody, to be honest, cared much what the Palestinians thought.
Yeah.
I mean, the best estimate I can find trying to sift through all the rage and lies is something about 750,000 Palestinians were expelled.
Mm-hmm.
And the narrative that Americans believed for most of my lifetime, which is a tribute to Israeli propaganda, is that, you know, they did it on purpose to rot in the camps so that just to become a nuisance.
Sort of like the Irish who would sit on the doorstep and starve themselves. Except not. I mean, I'm sorry.
I think it's pretty easy to get one Irish passive-aggressive psycho to do that. To get an entire population to do that is a little more tricky.
It's just amazing to me that I, when I was younger, because I didn't even hear or think anything differently, I just sort of accepted that story, the Israeli version of it. But when you think about it for 2 seconds, it makes absolutely no fucking sense whatsoever.
I didn't get fully cured of it until I got to know somebody, a good friend of mine whose family had been expelled from there. And
I know who you're talking about. Yeah.
It's particularly horrible because his mother was a blind Palestinian.
Right.
And the family couldn't cope with it. They were farmers, and you know, like a lot of farmers, the land was the whole deal to them, and the family disintegrated. They don't even know where half of them are now.
That is, and that's, you know, that's sort of also what happened with the American Indians and so on. I mean, that is a big part of genocide. When you force them off the land, they do tend to disintegrate. And that's kind of what's so, I guess, if there is something remarkable and lucky, you know, about the Armenians or Jews for that matter, it's that they still, that they didn't vanish. I mean, because generally you do, I think, in those circumstances. Like
usually you do. Usually you fall apart. And it gets back to that couplet, you know. This stuff works. Thou shalt not kill, but need not strive officiously to keep alive. You can kill people a lot of ways. Mm-hmm. You know, standing them up in front of machine guns is very crude. Mm-hmm. It is necessary, because especially once there are photographs, because there'll probably be a few photographs, but you can't really photograph the expulsion followed by cultural decay. It's much harder to be blamed for.
Mm-hmm. Sorry, just lost you there briefly in that last part. So I don't know, should we wrap up the Trump thing and move on to other related material? I mean, one of the segues that I missed was that you brought up, you know, what went on in the Punjab. And I believe that the wife of the in the couple, the pair that shot up the San Bernardino center on that county, the Christmas party, she's originally from Punjab and went to school and was probably radicalized out in Pakistan, Punjab, right?
If I'm not mistaken. Especially Kashmir. The Kashmiris are the most furious that I've seen. If you go to I read a lot of comment threads, because, you know, it's the only place where you can find out what people actually think of all this weird stuff.
They're usually completely crazy too, but
they draw a lot of crazy people, but Kashmiris are some of the most rage-filled people I've encountered in those comment sections. If she's from Kashmir, then she's probably very, very pissed off. It's created a permanent anger. Although, what it really does among Pakistanis is give something else to be mad about that isn't Pakistan's fault, because Pakistan is so messed up. If you go to these comment threads about something horrible that happens in Pakistan, it's like, well, what about Kashmir? And Palestine sort of functions the same way with a big section of Middle Eastern opinion. Like, you know, why are you going to do this horrible thing? Well, what about Palestine? And, you know, it's a good answer, because Palestine is a horrible situation. But it also gives you an out from dealing with whatever your guys are doing.
It's a good distraction that can be used by governments as well.
The U.S. has rage dangles too, like, oh, those Mexicans, oh, those Muslims. But, you know, it's naive to think that other cultures don't have the same kind of rage puppetry going on.
Right. So to change the subject then a little bit, change it to another area where a lot of this goes on. What's happening in Mosul? Have you followed? Because we had put that on our agenda for the last show, and then something completely new's happened now. I mean, it was ISIL took over Mosul, and that was had previously been the one city that the one little region that when we invaded Iraq, that Petraeus supposedly had performed some sort of miracle there. But now you have Turkey moving into Mosul. So I don't know. Tell us the way you see what's going on. What's the latest there?
Okay. Well, leading up to the Turkish thing, something really interesting happened in the U.S. defense establishment, because even though they won't admit it publicly, the U.S. Army and its training mission was deeply humiliated when Islamic State took over Mosul with basically a few hundred guys in pickup trucks, who were faced by two full divisions of the so-called Iraqi army. And those two full divisions just fled, just flat out fled. So there's been a serious inquiry within the defense establishment over, you know, who lost Mosul. There's a tradition of these in the U.S. defense is like, who lost China, you know, mm-hmm. who lost this?
Who lost South Vietnam, you know, we thought Arvin right. would have fought.
Yep.
Who'd have known, yeah.
So, yeah, yeah. And it's always after one of our very expensively trained and equipped allied forces mm-hmm. performs this mass bug out. So it turns out that a lot of American agencies were supposedly giving fairly honest accounts of what was happening in Mosul, which means al-Maliki has handed the command of the Iraqi army over to his political cronies. They are hated by the men. They are siphoning off funds. Morale is nowhere. I mean, the CIA, Defense Intelligence Agency, all these guys were saying that. But the U.S. Army unit in charge of Mosul, CENTCOM, which controls the Middle East, was saying in a hilarious Saigon press conference way, no, we're making progress. Everything's going really well. So now for once, maybe somebody in the U.S. Army will suffer for taking the bright side view.
That would be nice.
Anyway, so that's still in progress. But meanwhile, as the Kurds push down from Kirkuk towards Mosul, they took Sinjar, and they also took a little town called Bashika, northeast of Mosul. And Bashika doesn't matter very much. It's a little town that was once mainly Yazidi. The only time it ever hit the papers before this was when there was a famous stoning of a Yazidi woman who wanted to marry outside.
Oh, right.
Right. But all of a sudden, there are more than 2,000 Turkish troops in Bashika. And that's a little odd because Turkey is in a really vicious war with the Kurds of YPG in Syria. But people have this idea that there's something called the Kurds, mm-hmm. and there isn't. At the very least, there's the Kurds in Syria, who are really radical, heroic people. And the Kurds in Iraq, the people that I used to live with, and that's a much more complicated and murky situation. In the 90s, two factions of Iraqi Kurdistan were killing each other in a civil war. They make deals with the government in Iraq. They've made deals with just about everybody they can. And they're very close to Turkey. Most of the construction that I saw when I was there was by Turkish firms. Even the people are not particularly anti-Turkish. You might think they are, but you know, they have more pressing enemies, so they're not. So there are all these Turkish troops and tanks, too, sitting there well inside Iraq. And Iraq is so messed up that some parts of the government are saying, it's no problem, don't talk about it anymore. And others are saying, bomb them, bomb those Turks.
Yeah. They're asking for the Russians to bomb them, even, right? Because
yeah.
we can't.
Well, they want them bombed.
Yeah.
They want any bomber in the area, please yeah. bomb the Turks in Bashika.
They're like trying to flag down a bomber, like, you know, holding their thumb up.
over there. The Turks probably didn't expect this little mission to be discovered, and since it has been discovered and publicized, they've stopped sending in more troops. But it's still a very strange mission. Like, why all these tanks? This is a very armor-heavy force. Mm. Kurdish Peshmerga are not really an army-heavy force. They never have been. And Turkish troops are good. So 2,000 plus Turkish troops is a serious threat. Nobody quite knows what they're doing there. It's unlikely they're going to fight Islamic State, no matter what the official claim is. But Erdogan's official story now is, no, they're there to help the Peshmerga fight Islamic State.
I love it. You can use that excuse for anything.
Yep.
Can't you? I mean, like, yep. yeah, I'm rifling through your mother's medicine cabinet because I heard that Islamic State might be here. You know? I'm like, Jesus Christ.
Yep. Yep.
Yeah.
You get the feeling that he's laughing half the time. Like when he said he's going to start strikes in Syria, but it's mainly on Islamic State. And then according to people who watched those strikes on the ground, it's like, yeah, he hit this vacant lot that was a mile or so from an Islamic State position. Meanwhile, hitting the Kurds very, very hard.
So did you see the reports? Again, there's so much. I don't know how you sift through all this, because the more I'm trying to get into understanding the Syria war and just that whole kind of and how it bleeds over, the more just unbelievable levels of propaganda, disinformation, bullshit, conjecture, and so on. But, you know, it certainly seems plausible that this may have something to do with the fact there's no doubt that we're bombing and degrading ISIS revenue means, right? I mean, they're oil trucks that transport the oil, the refineries, they're sort of the infrastructure. And, you know, anybody who knows anything about the sort of the black market world knows that, I mean, you got to bring it to market, and it would make sense, and it seems obvious. Yeah, they're bringing it to market through Turkey and out of one of the ports, probably Ceyhan. And so the reports are saying that, and this, again, would also make a lot of sense, that there are all kinds of deals being cut between ISIS, Kurds, and Turks, and they're all, you know, wetting their beaks on it, even though they're fighting each other. I mean, I remember this going on in Chechnya in the first war. In the Yeltsin years, there were all kinds of sleazy arms deals going on. In fact, even before this, just before Putin invaded the second time, there were reports about Russian commanders that held garrisons near Chechnya, like inside of Dagestan or Stavropol, that area, where they would sell some of their own recruits into slavery to the Chechens for money. Yeah.
Wow. Yeah.
So yeah, anything is possible in the black market world, right?
Absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely. I mean, there are people speculating that this also has to do with the big fight over pipeline routes, and that Turkey is trying to tilt things in favor of a pipeline that runs north from Mosul. And if that's the case, there would be a lot of money in it, both for the Iraqi authorities in Baghdad and for the Kurdish authorities. In the north, although even there it gets, as you say, it gets incredibly Byzantine here, because there are two sets of Kurdish authorities, one in Sulaymaniyah where I was, and another in Erbil, two different Kurdish parties, two different families, clans, basically, running different fiefdoms in Iraqi Kurdistan. So God knows how many corporations and political parties and guerrilla groups are involved in a deal like that, but it's a very possible scenario.
Yeah, I guess we'll just have to wait and see how this thing, how it develops, but it is definitely a weird thing that Turkey just invaded secretly and then, that's us. Oh, should we just take a left turn? I don't know. I guess we'll stay here, but, you know.
This is not a border town. This is way inside.
Yeah. Yeah, and mountainous territory, right? Or no? Or is that so?
Yeah, it's not easy. It's northeast of Mosul. I mean, Turkey would have to come down presumably from the northwest, but this is well inside, and presumably that means those Turkish tanks moved with permission right through Iraqi Kurdistan.
So I think if you were to take the mean average of all the different theories about what's going on, it basically has to do with pipelines or smuggling routes of some kind, whether it's oil or natural gas or whatever. Something has to do with black market distribution. So moving on from there, there's talk now about whether we're going to introduce, as Michael Weiss would say, boots on the ground, and how many boots on the ground we're going to put in, because we're introducing a few dozen special forces, which I assume they're already running. I mean, they're already around practically every country in the world anyway. But I guess they're politically preparing us for more action like that. Obama in his speech about the San Bernardino shootings seemed to say pretty clearly he did not want a Michael Weiss boots on the ground scenario and thinks it's a bad idea, which I think is very sensible of him.
It's a terrible idea. It's a ridiculous idea.
But it's being pushed hard by a lot of people.
Oh, yeah.
You know, the other thing about Trump, I'll tell you, you brought this up somehow about population transfers usually come in the wake of wars. I think it's interesting, whenever Trump talks about whether it's banning Muslims or, expelling Mexicans, it's almost always in the same speech and very close to this. is talk about Iraq and talk about how incompetent Obama is. And it again reminds me of that Saline anecdote, that the only thing that matters to any civilization, certainly to American pensioners, white pensioners, is the last war you won and the next war you will win.
Yeah.
And that seems to be, you know, fueling some of this somehow. I mean, it's a very belated rage, anger, something over the fact that no matter how you look at it, no matter which way you look at it, we lost.
Yep. Yep. I remember watching that second Rambo movie. And at the time, I was still trying my best to be an American nationalist. It wasn't easy. And that movie made it a lot harder because there's Stallone with his greased up steroid face, and he says to his colonel, who wants him to go back to Vietnam, "Do we get to win this time?"
Exactly.
And I realized that that sentence is going to make sense for a lot of people watching this movie. And it's one of those moments where you start to feel alone and you start to feel my ideology is not coping with this situation.
It must be because everybody else is wrong and only my version of that American nationalism is right. So I'm a nationalist of one.
That's an important stage. I'm the only one doing it right. And then you have to abandon that too. I've talked to people who were in Iraq, and none of them want Americans who were in Iraq, and none of them think the boots on the ground idea makes any sense at all. I mean, it's just simple doctrine that people unite against a foreign enemy, against especially one who hasn't bothered to learn your language, doesn't share your religion, doesn't share anything about your culture, and who was there very recently shooting the hell out of the place, shooting anything that moved, basically. Of course, it's an idiotic idea, but I've read some of these calls for it, and the arrogance and stupidity of it is so stupid that I end up being almost impressed. You know how that whole neocon thing impresses you with just its raw persistence? Like seeing somebody who keeps walking forward into hard jabs for 15 rounds.
Yeah, except there aren't hard jabs. I don't know what it is. You would think they were because they're wrong. And so you would think the embarrassment of being so catastrophically wrong would be like a hard jab, but it's not.
Yeah.
It's more like, no, you want actually this other sinecure, this other think tank funded by Boeing and whoever the fuck else, you know? It's the
that's
opposite.
True.
It's infuriating.
In fact, that's an expression of my hopeless naivete that I think they must have been abashed. I don't think abashed is part of their makeup.
No.
But somebody sent me an article by Eli Lake, and it was about this boots on the ground thing, and he was arguing, and this is I think a pretty fair paraphrase. He was arguing we shouldn't let the refusal of the Iraqi government that we installed to permit American troops to stop us from introducing American troops who fucked the place up last time.
Right. I think Rocky was calling for an Eli Lake leader for the next war, you know? And I think Eli Lake was watching that movie and thinking, you know, Stallone needs me. I'll be that person who will say, "I'll let you win this time," you know? I mean, that's just so fucking stupid. I got to tell you, I met Eli Lake once briefly. It was, and you know, it was one of these things. A lot of journalists I know found him sort of comical and somewhat harmless because he's kind of a ridiculous character. He just happens to, you know, front for some very not ridiculous people
and
interests.
Yeah, you get a lot of Humpty Dumpty jokes.
Right? And all that stuff. It's not like that. So, and when I met him, it was some party in D.C. We were all fairly somewhat wasted, and he was talking the same tough talk, and it was just when Assange, it was at some point, first big point with Julian Assange when he had, released something or some big documents or other. So in late 2010, and he just kept saying to everybody, and these people were sort of around him, that, you know, we should assassinate him. We should kill him. We just send over special forces to him. And he was like, it was so ridiculous seeing this very short, bald, bespectacled, kind of Isaac Babel looking, you know, dweeb, yeah, talking this, that it was hard to take it serious. It was funny. It just struck me as absolutely funny that he
How
would,
were other people reacting to him?
You know, they just were kind of like, probably some people were sort of semi-impressed and some were just sort of impressed that he was saying pseudo-shocking, yeah, you know, pseudo-shocking, pseudo-right-wing things that you don't say in D.C. because everyone's so cowardly and cautious there. It's very easy to impress them and shock them with, you know, ooh, you can't say that.
Yeah.
I didn't even know who he was quite well enough at that point. He just, I mean, it seemed so ridiculous. I couldn't believe he was serious. Yeah. And he was. And, you know, that's who he is. I don't know. I mean, he just, he yeah, parrots other people who he admires. I mean, other bullies.
Wow. Well, you know, if I saw a column by him saying that, I don't think I'd be particularly surprised.
Yeah.
In fact, I seem to have a memory that somebody did write a column like that.
No, there was. There was briefly when I think Newt Gingrich or a few people came out and said that. And others said, yeah, are you out of your fucking mind? You're calling for, right, killing a journalist and so on. And so he being a journalist, you know, was out there backing it up and talking about how, you know, he's like, I know Israelis that you could send into Sweden. You send them in there. I wish I could remember the whole conversation. He was right down to like the kind of weapons you use and how you get in there.
Oh, they love their weapons.
Yes.
I mean, the nerdier they are, the more they love their weapons.
Yeah, and it's sort of like I have this kind of insider information from actually physically impressive people that I know. So if you mess with me, I'll just call them up. It seemed to be the implied subtext to it all.
My bodyguard, this stuff.
But anyways, yeah. So that was my brush with Eli Lake. Wow. Fairly ridiculous. I don't know. I feel like we should probably wrap this up. It's been going on, and I'm not even sure how to wrap this up because it's such a
I'll
a lot of it's pretty
it
gory
no
and depressing.
A little anecdote because if you remember, we were talking about war books and you mentioned All Quiet on the Western Front.
Yes.
I confess that I hadn't read that for years,
yes,
like 20 years, and I had only a vague memory of it.
Mm-hmm.
So I finally found an English language bookstore here and got a new translation of it. That's the first problem. Like, you know, it's translated by a professor of German at some English university, and I don't know. I don't think the professors of German really should be translating something like this because it's supposed to be in colloquial German. And the guy, Paul, the narrator, who's supposed to be a student, a middle-class German guy, is saying things like, "We got 4 cans of lobster, but mind you, we'd have rather had dripping." I don't know. It doesn't sound quite right to me. But anyway, I was reading for a while, and Catherine, who was across the room, said, "So, how do you like the book?" And I said, "Why?" And she said, "You were wincing."
Never a good sign.
But the reason I was wincing is that I'm reading this description of his unit of doomed friends being sent to the front and coming under sudden artillery fire because, you know, artillery is the only thing they fear.
Yeah.
You don't even get close enough to the front to get machine gunned. It's
right.
The shells that get you. And the shells start falling, and the only cover is a military graveyard. So they all duck behind the fresh grave mounds, and then the shells hit. So the shells are throwing up bodies and coffins and pieces of bodies, and one guy from their unit gets his arm smashed by a coffin and body that fall on it, and he screams in agony and tries to take off his gas mask. He can't take off the gas mask because the gas stays low and it loves holes, and they're cowering in this hole to avoid the shells. But if you go into the hole, the gas is even thicker there. So they have to wrestle him to the ground, and you know, then he dies anyway, because everybody dies anyway. And I'm thinking, God damn, this is a depressing book.
Yes. Yeah, it is a depressing
book.
Didn't
you say your father was dissuaded from
I was gonna say that's the story he tells, that he wanted to, when he was young, go to West Point or be an officer, go to one of those officer schools. It was he still loves to this day, you know, sit there and watch John Wayne movies still and so on, which is funny. But and then he said he I think he saw the movie, the old 30s version. And it so horrified him. He said, he said straight up, I said, fuck that. I'm not going to war. And and that was it. And, you know, he wound up serving in some, you know, reserves during Vietnam. So he got out of that. Even he called it the Flying Typewriters unit or something. He got very lucky. Yeah.
Yeah. Very wise. Yeah. I mean, to make a rough generalization, the Second World War was worse for civilians, but the first was by far worse for soldiers.
Yeah, no glory at all.
No.
That's the one thing I didn't quite understand about Hitler. He was sort of like, what? It's over. We were just getting started. And he was there from the beginning. I mean, you've got to be a real loon. And he just, all he could think about was, how do we get this thing going again? Best time of my life.
He was focusing on the East, you know, where they were winning most of the time. Okay.
But wasn't he wasn't in the West ever?
Can't remember.
Maybe towards the end.
I can't handle Hitler.
Yet. I know. He's an asshole. Okay. So the book is suitably, because that was how I remembered it. Like, it was really, it didn't turn me, a 15-year-old, you know, war dweeb, as a lot of 15-year-olds were, didn't turn me against war, but it was suitably horrifying, and it really stood out from the other boring books that they, you know, had us read in the English class. Like, I mean, it just, all I remember were, you know, Dickens and some other crap. I can't.
No, it's very, quiet is a good word for it. I mean, that's in the English title, not really the German one. The German title is more literally From the West, No News. But quiet is a good word for it. He talks about all this stuff very deadpan, and like most good military or prison stories, the main thing that it's about is food. I mean, they get much more excited about food than carnage.
It's funny. I mean, the way you just described it, it sounds a lot grimmer and worse than Celine's descriptions of World War One in Journey to the End of the Night, which are a lot more grotesque and wild.
Yes.
I don't know, and fun almost.
Well, some of Celine's descriptions there are meant to be enjoyed.
Like
that strutting French officer who makes a point of strolling along the top of the trench and then gets his bowels blown out and dies screaming. That's comedy.
Yeah, no, and the other officer yelling at everybody and then his head's missing and the neck looks like a boiling pot of jelly is how I remember it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, that doesn't really happen in All Quiet on the Western Front. Yeah. It's the grunts who suffer.
And on that lovely note, we will end this episode of Warner. I think it's the 10th episode. And again, I want to thank everybody, all of our subscribers. We sent you all out notices about the little mix-up with trying to go from monthly to per show. We're sticking with per show. Anybody has any questions about that, again, please just email us at radiowarnerd@gmail.com. But it seems to me that everything has gone okay. We'll see again by the end of this month. Thank you also to Yasha Levine, our comrade, for all the help he's given us. And we're hoping actually to be able to give you all direct download links pretty soon. And Yasha's helping us with that. And thank you to Paul Carr, Sarah Lacey at Pando, and all of our subscribers. And Yahweh.
Oh, definitely Yahweh. Don't leave him out or he gets mad.
Very mad. Okay. All right. Bye-bye.
Okay. Bye-bye.